Welcome to the Marist Review. I'm so happy to be talking today to Morgan Jerkins. She's the New York Times bestselling author of This Will Be My Undoing. She's a senior editor at Medium's Zora magazine. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker, Vogue, The New York Times, and many other outlets. She lives in New York, and her latest book is called Wandering in Strange Lands. Welcome, Morgan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. Hanging in there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what a pleasure. So, Morgan, this book is such a great mix of your personal story and your family's personal story with more reported stuff.
Right.
Tell me about that balance.
Okay. It was hard because in the beginning, I didn't plan on putting my personal story in it at all. I thought I was just going to be going into these communities and finding their distinctions, but also unifying forces like land displacement, state violence, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the first couple of drafts obviously didn't come together. My editors were like, you have to put yourself in it. And I didn't want to because my first book, This Will Be My Undoing, was so personal.
Right.
So even though I didn't intend to hide, I was hiding because I wasn't really writing about myself and I wasn't showing that I had a stake in this as well as a potential reader had a stake in it. And so once I finally had like this come to Jesus moment with both my agent and editors, then I actually went backwards in a sense to start to interview family members. And then magically somehow, when I looked through all the transcriptions from the interviewees that I talked to throughout my journey across the country, they seemed to be in dialogue with each other. So it ended up working out.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me a little bit about how you planned where to go on your trip, like a reverse Great Migration.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Oh, okay. So for me, like the reason, like I knew where to go first with like the Low Country, South Carolina, and Georgia because of food. And mm-hmm. I talk about this in my first chapter. Like, I know I can get soul food in Los Angeles. I can get soul food in Mississippi. I can get soul food anywhere. So that was one of the most significant parts of my life as an African-American. Mm-hmm. And I started to just look for certain things that intrigued me about a Sunday dinner or tradition. And one of the traditions was, you know, eating collard greens for money and black eyed peas for good luck on New Year's Day. And I realized that actually originated from the Low Country. And when I did more research on the Low Country, I realized that the Gullah Geechee people there, which is a sub-ethnic group of African-Americans, they are the group that has had the highest retention rates of West African traditions. So I said, okay, I may not be able to go to the particular country in West Africa where my family originated, but I can start here.
Right.
I knew that I had to go to Louisiana because my father's family is Creole, so I had to go there. And then with regards to Native American identity or lack thereof, a mystery mm-hmm. of many different black families, I knew I wanted to go to Oklahoma because that's where a lot of Native American families that black people say that they have ties with, they were based in the South and they were forced to move west of Mississippi into Indian Territory known as Oklahoma because of the Trail of Tears, because Andrew Jackson and Manifest Destiny and all that. And then I ended up in California because geographically, that's the last place to go. And yeah. Initially, I didn't want to go there because I'm like, why do I need to go to California? And all the people I spoke to, some scholars were like, you can't just go to the South and the Midwest and not go west. You have to go there. You'd feel a disservice to your project if you just left it without that region. So that's how I ended up there.
And also, your uncle's produced Brandy's first album. Just had to mention it.
Second album. Yeah, her Never Say Never. Okay. Yeah, it was like, when I tell people that, they're like, that's your uncle? I didn't know that. I'm like, I thought everyone knew that because his last name is my last name. That last name's not common, but people did not know.
I have to give you credit there. Tell me more about the Gullah Geechee people and how you made connections there, how you found the people who would guide you and show you around.
Right. So every time I went to a different region, I told myself, you can't just go there. It's probably best if you do some preliminary research on the cultures in that particular region. So I spent a lot of time at the Schomburg, which is a part of the New York Public Library system, and it's based in Harlem. And then I would make contact with people. And the way that I made contact was like looking up documentaries, finding the people's names that were in the documentaries, finding people that made op-eds locally about the culture, and then reach out to them. I told them my name. I gave my professional website. I told them my publisher, and to show that the book deal actually did exist.
Yep.
Because these are vulnerable communities. And one of the women that I spoke to, her name was Tiffany Young. She's a non-institutional historian, and she was my liaison. And each time I was getting in touch with someone in different places, and they were like, okay, I'll tell you who to speak to and help you through that. Because as I mentioned earlier, these communities are vulnerable. People have gone into the communities before and they create scholarship off of what they found without giving proper acknowledgement. So it definitely was a thing. I had to go in haphazardly.
Right.
With these people. And that's how I found. I spoke to them before I even went. So they had some familiarity with me and what I was going to do.
And there are things I just, you know, I had heard about the Gullah Geechee people. I know that they were rice farmers, both in Africa and then.
Yeah.
But their erasure now is shocking. Let's talk about in particular Hilton Head Island, which I've always heard is a lovely place to vacation.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mentioned in my book that drive from Savannah, Georgia, where I was staying, across, you know, the interstate into Hilton Head was one of the most beautiful drives I've ever gone on in my life. And I don't even like driving like that. But when you go there, the word plantation is ubiquitous.
Right.
Anything from the stores at the strip malls to the gated communities where the descendants of the formerly enslaved, the Gullah people that lived there, they're not living there. They hardly have access to it.
Right.
So it was very perverse, as I mentioned. There, like this line, this blurred line between leisure and slavery, basically, or the vestiges of slavery. And that's what I wanted to draw attention to. And I was so thankful that the New York Times chose that particular excerpt to work with, because it is an issue. And it's not just happened Hilton Head, but all along the Low Country, because it's such a beautiful region of the country.
Right.
But I want people to consider, what are the consequences of making that place so beautiful and modernized and marketable for outside tourists? And that oftentimes the marginalized people there, which in this case are the Gullah Geechee people, get pushed towards the margins and oftentimes inevitably displaced.
Right. And I mean, you talk about it in the book, your first trip to an actual plantation, and that must, I mean, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never been on a plantation tour before, and I never really had interest in it. I think I just felt in my heart that like plantation tours are for white people. It's not for me to go there and to try to, you know, anesthetize the stories, because nobody goes on a leisure tour of any grand estate, even if it is a plantation, to hear about the brutality. They usually don't. They want to hear about everything else. So when I went there, I went with Tiffany, who as I mentioned earlier, is a non-institutional historian, and she was telling me that she's been trying to get a historical marker there for those who toiled at this plantation, including some of her ancestors. And it's been an uphill battle to do that. But it just goes to show, like, if you, like, when you went to the rice plantation, like, the energy was just so thick and it was so palpable. Not to mention it was hot. And I remember, like, she took me out towards the water and she was, like, saying to me, like, do you see that crocodile over there? And I said, where? She's like, where? It's like, where is it? And I'm like, she's like, right there. And it took a couple of minutes. And I was like, oh, there it is. Man, if I would have had to be out here, I would have died. And she's like, well, many people did die.
Yeah.
So imagine, like as you said earlier, a lot of these enslaved Africans, they were brought over to these rice plantations because they knew how to cultivate rice already because of where they originated from in West Africa. And so when they come here to build the levees and the dikes and to, you know, have that rice, you know, they're in the water and they can lose their life because of what is there, or lose their life because of the brutality of slave masters. So every time I look at a pack of rice now, especially if it says like Carolina King or something like that, I'm reminded of those plantations that I visited.
And you talk a lot about the fear of water and not swimming and how that is perhaps connected to that in terms of generational trauma, even that mm-hmm. passes along.
Right, right. It's intergenerational trauma. And, you know, water is such a complex topic for African Americans, because we often make fun of the fact that, you know, we don't swim because of our hair or we're going to drown. But beneath that humor that we often laugh to keep from crying, it's like there's really some deep stuff there. I mean, think about the water, what it constitutes with regards to slavery, what it with regards to just freedom. You know, mm-hmm. enslaved Africans, some enslaved Africans crossed water in order to get to freedom during slavery. So not only can the water constitute, you know, freedom, it can constitute death, it can constitute humor, it can constitute, you know, sadness. It runs the gamut, because that's pretty much what encapsulates African American experiences.
Yeah. And then tell me about this was your mother's side of your mm-hmm. family. Mm-hmm. Tell me how they reacted upon hearing about your reporting.
Oh, I mean, they just wanted to talk. And I was really thankful that, you know, we got to have that time together. I think writing this book has actually brought me closer to both our family on both sides. But, you know, the chapter where I talk about why my mother's side of the family, my maternal grandfather's side, left the South, my mother never heard that story before. Mm. And my mother's in her 50s. So when she heard it, that was her first time hearing it too. And I just think about the fact that, like, even the way he started was like, I guess I could talk about it. Now, I almost felt like there was a fear to talk about it because of what can happen. And what I wanted to demonstrate with that story is, like, for some African American families who were part of the Great Migration, it was just a simple accident. It was a simple mm-hmm. Walk down the road, certain road. It was a simple drive. It was a simple, you know, turn of phrase, or your voice got too loud, that can change the trajectory of your family's story forever. You know, just in a split second.
Tell me for our listeners, will you tell us exactly what happened?
So basically what happened was my maternal great-grandfather hit a white man, and he hit a white man. He was driving, he hit a white man. I had no idea if the white man died or if he lived, but it didn't matter,
right?
Because he knew that he had to leave. At the time that he was alive, Georgia was second to Mississippi in terms of lynchings. And as a child growing up, he heard people being lynched, like actually heard them. So he knew that he had to go. So right. What happened was the white man that he actually worked for, he actually put him in the back of his trunk and drove him as far as he could to the water to escape. And it wasn't until another black man's body was found floating in that water that he decided it was okay for him to come back. I guess the people were out for revenge, or whoever they could find. So I didn't know that story. My mother didn't know that story. And I'm sure, why would anyone tell that story? Because right. Maybe they were afraid that, even in spite of the distance, that, like, they would, you know, it would be retribution. And granted, my great grandfather did end up coming back, and the man he worked for out in the cotton field actually defended him with a Winchester rifle and said, you know, if anyone takes the first step, you know, I'm going to shoot him. But even after my great grandfather had a family, he stayed there for a couple more years, but he was always afraid that something was going to happen. And that's when they made the move to Philadelphia.
Yeah. And then you get to your dad's side of the family. And you didn't have a really rich relationship with your father at the time. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that, about digging into his past and your past and learning more.
Yeah, my dad has been like an enigma to me. Like, my dad is very much like, you know, I lived with my mother, so I didn't really know much about my dad's side of the family like that. And my dad, he would always say a couple things here and there about living in North Carolina, because that's where he was born and raised. But sometimes he would say something even deeper than that, but then wouldn't go into it. So it always felt like an enigma to me of some sort. And it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years ago that I even knew my father was Creole. I had no idea. Mm. he never brought it up. And, you know, me growing up in New Jersey, I didn't know of any other Creole people, so I had no other frame of reference. So that was always a site of intrigue, because it complicates notions of blackness or, you know, learning about different sub-ethnic groups beyond just African-American, like a large swath of people. So it was very, very fascinating for me to try to unpack that.
Yeah, and it's, you struggle in the book with creating some sort of understanding or definition of what being Creole means.
Yes, because to this day, people cannot settle on one, they can't settle on one term of what Creole means. So it's very, very complicated. And it also arouses feelings among Black people, not all of them, but certain Black people, because even for me, like when I was growing up, I just thought they were light-skinned, uppity Black people who didn't want to be called Black. They wanted to be called everything else with a dash of Black as a footnote, so to speak. So it was very interesting going down there and realizing that when we think of racial binaries or ethnic binaries in this country, it can't be a either or. Louisiana was not a part of the United States at one point, and because of that, they didn't have that strict you are either or, that strict racial binary. It wasn't until they became Americanized and then also through the intensification of Jim Crow that things really started to change.
And then even when you go to Oklahoma, that you find that the racial binary there has displaced so many different people who are both indigenous and Black.
Yep. I mean, growing up, I heard many Black families that all say they have a little Indian in them. And I'm like, whatever. And, you know, even in certain circles today, I read online where it's like Indian is often seen as, if a family member claims Indian, it's because they're dealing with like intergenerational trauma, whether it's because they don't want to tell their family that their ancestor was raped by a white person, or they just don't want to be seen as 100% Black, which no descendant of enslaved people is 100% Black. But yeah, like, you know, I've never was taught that when the Trail of Tears happened, when Andrew Jackson forced the 5 civilized tribes, which by the way, originated in the South, when he forced them west of the Mississippi, I didn't realize that both enslaved, refugee and free Black people went with them.
Yeah. So I had no idea.
That was never taught to me. And I think that's like the undercurrent of the entire book is the of the school system in this country. I had no idea. And so when I realized that, and when I speak to people who identify as freedmen, basically because of their African ancestry, and they're often stigmatized within their own tribes, their nations, they told me before Oklahoma even became a state, before that one drop pool thing became so calcified in their laws and their statutes, they were all one. So there wasn't either or. And that's hard to sort of disentangle myself from, because I'm an American, and also I was, you know, I wasn't born back then. I don't know what that means. All I know is divisions. All I know is classifications.
And the classifications really came into play with, I mean, again, in school I learned about the Dawes Act.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what that meant for ethnic binaries.
Yeah, for freedmen, like if you were a freedman, it meant that you are of African descent. The problem with that is if you looked Black, you could be put on the freedman roll. So in one family, one could be considered by blood, a citizen by blood, another could be considered a freedman. Now, if you are a freedman, that means you have no blood degree. Blood quantum, which many Native American activists say is racist in and of itself, having a particular fraction of blood. And so nowadays, there are freedmen, particularly in the Seminole Nation, for example, where it's like you are allowed to vote at the time. You're allowed to vote. I've seen their cards. Like you vote only, it says. You're allowed to vote, but you're not going to have access to perhaps educational benefits, health care, for example, clothing, all housing, right? Because you don't have the blood degree. So because of this classification that happened, you know, over 150 years ago, and because by nature of you being Black, it completely wipes out any indigenous blood that you have. Or even still, it's like what some of the freedmen argue is that it didn't have to do with blood to begin with. before all of this. We were all one. So why are we going mm-hmm. by blood degree?
And then you even get into, this was really shocking to me, that Ancestry.com and other DNA sites are kind of full of shit.
They are, because for one, it's so hard for me when I listen to Black people, and I mentioned this in the book, where like, yeah, I was told this, but DNA said no. Well, it's like, most Native American communities do not give their DNA to corporations, and why would they? Why would they trust the state? Why would they trust these capitalist organizations to tell them about their identity and their tribe or their nation? So, and I use an example woman, Darnella Davis, who knew that she was Cherokee and Creek and grew up in a multiracial, non-segregated part of Oklahoma. And when she took the test, it said, oh, first you're 13%, then you're 25%. And it's like, well, both of her family members were a part of different Native American tribes. So what does that have to say?
Right. It's a lab test just doesn't explain the entire story.
Exactly.
And you went to a protest.
Yep.
Tell me about that.
I went to a protest in Seminole County, Oklahoma, which was a bit of a drive from Oklahoma City where I was staying. And, you know, I was out there with a bunch of other freedmen, particularly from Seminole Nation. And it was an eye-opening experience because I met Black, you know, I just assume if you're African-American, your first language is English. Or perhaps French, if you're, you know, right. in Louisiana. And these Black people were like, no, my first language was Creek, Muscogee Creek, which is what Seminoles speak. And when I went out there, there were these white men in white pickup trucks circling around with their windows down. And, you know, one of them said, you're lucky, because if this was last year, they would have been calling us the N-word. And I could just felt like something out of the 1960s. And, you know, that whole day was intense because they sat out right outside the Indian Bureau of Affairs, the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA, and just was protesting like 3 or 4 hours. And then my liaison, Leada Osborne Sampson, Sampson Osborne, but she took me to the Seminole County Courthouse. She showed me around, and we actually being followed. We actually had two Seminole freedmen men who were escorting us to the courthouse. And I asked her why, because one of them was from Wichita, Kansas, which is about 3 hours from Seminole County. And she said, well, he often accompanied me to meetings because her life has been threatened before because of the activism that she does. So we had them accompany us, and they did not, you know, leave until they saw us back on the highway. So I often wonder, like, what would have happened that day? I mean, I looked out of place out there. They knew I wasn't from there. What would have happened that day if they were not with us when we were being followed? And she was telling me stories about ancestors disappearing after the land allotments they had, people being murdered, found in their homes, family members of her being driven off the road. It was just intense. It was the most intense day, I think, out of the entire, probably the most intense day on my entire research journey across the country.
Tell me a little more about your personal safety in all of this. That was the worst day, but...
Yeah, I mean, to this day, I'm still processing and wondering how did I get that done, because I'm only 5 feet tall. Some places that I went to, Oklahoma, the low country, I had liaisons in those areas, but I was driving around by myself. Mm-hmm. And I did mention to someone, like, when I was in Oklahoma, I'm actually shocked I didn't have a gun or a weapon of any kind with me, because I was driving on these highways, and at one point, Oklahoma had the most, has had or still has the most sundown towns in the entire country. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later on that I realized, when I was driving from Oklahoma City to Tulsa, or when I went to lunch with a Black Creek man, that was in a sundown town. Had no idea. You know what I'm saying? So it's one of those things where it's like, I took a risk. And I mean, even the liaison I had in Oklahoma before we went to the protest, she said to me, man, if you were my daughter, like, I'd be afraid. Mm. You know, I knew I had a deadline to reach. I knew that I had to get this done. But to this day, I'm like, how did I do that with not a single weapon, without a single self-defense class? What I did was I tried to treat myself as a teenager. So I tried my best to, like, anytime I got a rental car, immediately take pictures of the license plate and to send to, like, my mother and my friends, let them know where I'm staying. And when, and I tried to make sure, and it didn't always happen because sometimes the day is very long, that I would get in before sundown. And I would make sure I told someone I was in, not the hotel, in my actual room. Once I made it to my actual room, then I would message someone.
Room number, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
How did your, was your family worried? Was your family...
Yeah, I think my mom was worried. I mean, I guess she was less worried because this was the United States and it wasn't like, you know, she always sees me taking solo trips overseas. She's like, well, how does she do that? So, yeah, but I didn't really tell her about what happened in Oklahoma. I just told her how everything was going. I was still trying to process it. But yeah, I think my family was like, oh, you're here now? Because it was happening. The research was happening so fast. I would spend a week here or a week here. And so I think they were worried, but at least they knew that I was still stateside and I was reaching out to other Black people and all, and I was trying to give them as much information as possible.
And then you went to LA for the final part of the journey. Yep. And you talk about a lot about, I mean, it's part of the American dream, right? That California is just the place where all of the magic happens.
Yeah, and I think I wanted people to understand that, like, even African-American migrants, they may have went to Oklahoma and they still wanted to go to California. They may have migrated to Chicago. They still wanted to go to California, you know what I mean? And, you know, as a millennial, like, I grew up on Laguna Beach and the hills, and how does it start? With the full montage of the palm trees, you know, the beach lines, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, the good-looking people. And what I wanted to elucidate with that is the disappointment, basically, with, like, your ancestors, your elders fled to this sunny town, this sunny county, and they found the same problems in a different area code. And that's what attributes to Black rage with these riots and protests that happen. And so that's, I think, with the book coming out at this time, it feels really prescient because when I say in the book, like, I was hanging out with an underground rapper while I was in LA. He witnessed the 92 riots, so uprising. And we were standing at the intersection of Florence and Normandy, which is when the 92, when the Rodney King riots began. And I asked him, I said, do you think this is going to happen again? And he said, you know, I'm a paraphrase, but he said, if this country doesn't reckon with what it has done to Black people, it's going to happen again. And almost 2 years to the day, that's when the George Floyd protests happened. So, you know, we have to deal with this cycle.
It certainly, I close your book and then take a look at the news and think, oh, you really nailed it. Thank you so much, Morgan. This is so wonderful. Tell me a little bit about what you've been reading lately that you'd like to recommend.
So I finished Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. Oh my God, that was earlier in the lockdown. Oh my gosh. And I ate that up. It's a big book, but I ate that book up. I'm reading Severance by Ling Ma, even though everyone's like, no, don't read that. But I like the way she writes.
Yeah.
I'm going to take it slow because I can definitely start, so I'm going to take it slow with that. Other books that I always recommend on shows, The Drift by Namwali Sarpel, Sing Unburied Sing by Jasmine Ward. I really, really love that book. Temporary by Hilary Leichter, pronouncing her last name correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the books that I would recommend. Oh, and In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado.
I love this list. Morgan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.